When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. This is your host, Rachel Jamieson. Today I have with me Rob Kaiser from York Meadow Farm and Natural Ferments, which is a brand that he has. And he is out of, and I'm going to say it wrong, but I believe this is right, Medina, Ohio. I knew I was saying it wrong. So Rob, we wanted to have you on because you have a story about, you know, how you started your farm and your ferments and all of that. And, but it's kind of a family thing. So tell me how you got here, how you, Rob, ended up being the person heading this up, and then how you came on with your family and joined them with what they were doing.
Okay. I will do my best to provide a summary because, like many family operations, there's many layers and it's complex. But in 2005 or so, my parents bought this land, and all of us siblings, myself, my brother, and my sister, were all living in different parts of the country. And, there was nothing here. And the whole objective when they bought this land was this was going to be where they built their retirement home. And that was just going to be it. A portion of the land was farmed commercially. And they were okay with that because they could have it. You know, the tax valuation was agricultural land, and they were able to capitalize on that. After a few years of watching commercial farming take place, they realized we don't want this on our land and we want to do something different. But so in order to maintain that tax valuation, they had to do something with it. So mom was working as a nurse at that time, talked with a guy named Maurice Small, who does some very cool things. He currently lives in Atlanta, but at that time he was living here in Cleveland working with an organization called City Fresh. And they said, well, what should we do? And it started with blueberries and berry plants. So a few years in, around 2010 or something like that, I flew back into town and helped it was probably before that. Doesn't matter. I helped my parents plant 100 blueberry plants. And then by that time, they had started a small market garden and then were taking produce, basic stuff, green beans, cherry tomatoes, basic stuff that everybody kind of starts off with, the easy stuff. And they were taking that to market. And then that evolved into bath and body products and, you know, little experiments with biscotti and sourdough bread. My dad was making sourdough bread, and that was a big hit. And then they started experimenting with other things, and he started making pickles, and the pickles were a big smash. And then that led into other fermented food experiments. And by this time, I had moved back from where I was living at that time, Southern California, because this was like 10 years ago now. I moved back, wanted to get involved, didn't know how. So I got a job, kept working, did a bunch of dumb things to try and grow the farm and the land and the business. And over the course of those dumb things that I did personally to grow all of the infrastructure and things here, the experiments and the market business went from seasonal produce to bath and body products that mom was making and fermented foods that dad was making. And that became successful and popular. So that's what they stuck with. He stopped making bread and doing some other things. The gardening went in a different direction. We have a tenant farmer now who manages the market gardens and the high tunnel that I built. And it got popular enough, this hobby of his with the fermented foods, that we decided that we were going to try and grow it. And a few years ago, we went and toured the operations of another local company that's doing it at a bigger scale. And we tried to replicate what they were doing and how they are doing it. And we did. And I decided that I can talk about getting serious with this and talk about helping out, or I can actually do it. So I buckled down and worked hard, long hours, and paid off my debts and saved some money and quit my job last year and worked a full season with my dad at market. And he was diagnosed with cancer in March, passed away in May, and I have been running it since then. And the plan continues just to keep it growing. So that's as nutshell as I can make it.
Yeah. Hearing you talk about that, I'm remembering all of it because I've been following your podcast all the time. And, you know, we've been friends online, and I remember all this now, and what you have done and what your family did in such a short time. It's pretty fascinating. And the farmer's market, and you still do the farmer's market, don't you? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you guys did all these things, but then you honed in on some specific things and took out, like, do you still sell fresh vegetables at the market?
No.
Or your tenant farmer, which is Cody,
that's,
right?
Yeah, that's Cody. Cody does everything with the veggies in his own markets. That's basically his operation up there. He runs it all.
Okay. Yeah. So what you take to the market now is your Bath and Body and your ferments, and is that it?
Okay. Yep.
And what about, I don't remember hearing about the blueberries. So do you do anything with the original blueberries, or does Cody now he just manages all the produce and fruit and everything?
The blueberries, the blueberries are there. They're alive. We did some experiments and to try and cover them. I mean, we had individual, when the plants were small, we had individual row covers with like rebar and conduit, and that worked until the plants got too big. And then we tried to construct some giant netting using pond, like pond netting over top of it. And then that was just a real pain in the butt to put up. And we did that for maybe a year or two. And then.
Okay. And was that so, just birds are coming in and eating it? Is that?
And yep. Predators? We basically pick them and eat some, and the birds get the rest. So we don't really do anything with the blueberries other than admire them and get tasty treats when we can.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I don't remember hearing about that. Now with you guys, so how many people now are working there? Is it just you and your mom?
It's yes. And then Cody is doing his thing, and he's got a couple people that work part-time with him. So,
okay.
But yeah, with us and what we do specifically at the market with York Meadow Farm, it's my mom and I.
Okay. That's it. And your mom is mostly doing the Bath and Body products, or is she helping also with the ferments? Because I know you're in the kitchen a lot doing your ferments.
Yeah, that's what she does. And then the ferments is what I do. I'm trying to learn. I mean, I've made a couple batches of soap because I would like to, you know, we're not going to live forever. You know, we talk about this. So I want her to continue doing this and learning the things that she's learning, because I'd like to continue doing that. I'd like to change the way that I obtain produce and do things a little bit more seasonally and so on and so forth, and have winter projects be Bath and Body products. And I have some ideas about
okay.
you know, marketing things that could be done for like the manly man and taking advantage of this giant thing.
Right. He's petting his beard.
Yes. My giant beard. I think there's some, you know, kind of masculine oriented products that could be, sure. there's a market there, but I don't know how to do these things yet. So there's a lot to learn, and that could make a pretty well balanced year round operation.
So right now,
farm stuff.
The farmer's market, does it end in the fall then? And
it ends in the fall, and then there's a winter market that starts in December, and there's like a pre Christmas market, and then it goes every other weekend.
Okay.
In January until March. So that's been a pretty, last year was the first year that they did it, or at least the first year that we attended. It's a newer market, but it's been pretty successful. So we have the luxury here in Medina to do market related activities 10 months out of the year, 11 months out of the year, with some regularity, and with the winter seasons being a little slower than peak season.
That makes sense. But you also have added in, you are making ferments now and taking them to like stores, and you ship.
Yes. Yeah.
So does that still not keep you completely busy in the summer or in the winters?
It does with the, yeah. And that's definitely, learning how to navigate that is challenging, because I have to have a back stock of inventory ready, so that when somebody says, hey, I need 7 cases of, you know, various assortments of products, I can say, yes, I'll have that to you tomorrow.
Okay.
So it's, yeah, I'm making far more than I did at this time last year, because we have 3 different retail locations, and next year we'll be in a 4th. Okay. And we don't do a lot of online sales, in large part because I don't promote that like I could, because I'm still trying to learn how to navigate all of this, and I'm just trying to support the commitments that I have, and not push for anything new until I figure out how to do that successfully. Okay. Then I can start exploring new options.
Very cool. So
new options that are also already kind of existing in a sense.
How did that look when you decided, okay, I am feeling like I need to grow from just doing the farmer's market to taking this to stores? Like, did you just approach a store and say, here's my stuff, would you taste it? What do you think?
They approached, I'm thinking back, because initially when it happened, Dad was kind of managing things and I was helping, and they approached him. One is a smaller kind of mom and pop type of farm store. The other is a secondary location of a larger family owned operation, but they opened up a big store, and there's also a coffee shop and a brewery in the basement and a catering business. So they've got a lot going on there. They're like a hub of operations, and they're kind of inspiring us to rethink what we're doing here in terms of York Meadow Farm just operating as what we're doing, and serve as more of like a hub of operations. And that's kind of a little bit of a teaser into the whole rebranding of the fermented food line. Right. But yeah, they approached us, and then the largest wholesale account that we have also approached us, because one of their fermented food manufacturers, something's going on. I have a sneaking suspicion of what it is. I'm not at liberty to say, it's not my business,
right?
But they were looking to carry additional fermented foods in their store. And I said, absolutely, I can do that. And So, yeah. So, and then even this fourth person who is opening up a store at their, on their property, a small farm store, much like Richardson Farms, they approached us. So everyone has kind of approached us and said, okay, hey, we hear about you. We know about you. Do you want to sell to us? And
that's
that's
such a
yes.
compliment.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's interesting because, you know, part of me struggles with the fact that I have to sell wholesale at wholesale prices, but at the same time, I'm not doing a market. I don't have to take the stuff to market. I don't have to set up at market. I don't have to break down at market. I don't have to spend. I mean, a market day for everybody that does a market or doesn't do a market. I mean, you're up at 5 and packing the truck at 6:30 and then getting to the market location at 7:30 or 8 to open the market at 9 and go till 1. And then you're breaking down and getting home at 2:30 and then putting things away. And that's just right. Offloading the truck. And it's like an entire day. So to have somebody sell the product and then give it to them at a discounted wholesale price kind of makes it worth it because time is money and you're saving a lot of time having someone else sell your stuff.
Yeah. And then a lot of times that's what on the weekends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's your Saturday. You don't really get weekends. So the wholesale could be nice because you can make your schedule a little bit more of a schedule and, you know, 9 to 5, if you wanted to.
But I'd like to think that if it can get to the point where either I just bring extra, like extra meaning, you know, whatever I'm not sitting on to fulfill these contracts, which everything is still so new. I still don't have enough data, if you will, to like make projections on what is upcoming and what's going on. I'd like to get to a point where either I take just extra big air quotes to market, or I can just go to market as a part-time vendor and just go when I have an abundance of stock that I'm not selling. Okay. There's a lot that I don't know and a lot of uncertainty, which is, it used to be intimidating and mildly terrifying, but it's kind of become exciting because I have to figure out what the future has in store. And even though like everything is out of my control, that to some extent I'm responsible for how it goes.
Okay.
That's cool.
Yeah. So going back, and maybe you don't know the answer to this since your parents kind of started it. Like, did you have to get a food license? And do you have, I know that you have a kitchen. So do you have like a kitchen that was inspected in order for you to go and do all this, or is yours still small enough that you're under like Ohio's cottage food laws? How is that working and how has that process been?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we started doing everything, it was all sort of experimental and we did not have a commercial kitchen here, but we were leasing out commercial kitchen space at a place in town. And because when if you're making fermented foods, it's similar to cottage food laws, but it's different because you have to make it in a USDA inspected facility and you have to have log books indicating like when batches were made and when they were packed and a bunch of information. And the log books need to be kept at that location. So we had a space at a kitchen in locally that helped us, and we kept our logbooks there, and according to anybody that was inquiring about our operations, we made the product there because that's where the logbooks were kept.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. And initially we didn't know it. When Dad started this, he didn't know what he was doing. So he just did it. And he would take bulk batches to the market and then scoop it out. Like if you wanted 8 ounces or a pound, you would just weigh it out and scoop it out and do that. But that's not cool. So they shut him down and said, Bob, you can't do this. So he said, okay, well, I'm just not going to sell it. But I'll take donations for it. And they're like, okay, fine. Like, we're not going to say you can't do that because we don't have control over that. So he kind of did this bootleg kraut thing for a season. And then
kraut
we
just bootlegging kraut.
Yeah. Like bootleg kraut out of a cooler, donations only. So that was for the first year. That's kind of how that went down. And then it became more legitimate with experimental packaging, different types of containers for the next year or two. And then we finally, I think it was 2020 when we toured the facility and saw how they packed it, how they jarred it up, and then we replicated it, their production methodology exactly.
And yeah, we've so been now doing you that have for the past a kitchen 3 years. Though.
Yeah, we ended up building the kitchen in our barn in 2021 and finished it. Oh God, time is all combining now. But I think towards the end of the year last year, in 2021, we were operating out of our commercial kitchen on site. And then last year was the first full year that we're operating in our kitchen. And then this year was the second year and managing kind of and dealing with the inspector myself because.
Right. Yeah. How hard has that been to build the kitchen, get it approved and the inspections? Is that a lot of work to do that?
It's not as hard as you would think.
If you don't mind me asking, was it really expensive?
No, because there's all there's a lot. I guess, first of all, it depends on what one would define as expensive, because it's going to cost. Like if you're doing this, we decided that we were going to get serious about this and actually make a go at it and, do it. And we were already renting out the commercial kitchen space for what amount of money, I don't know. It's going to vary on the kitchen and the location and your drive time and all of this. So those costs are kind of variable. I think I designed the kitchen, just the space, and it's basically just an open room. It's not a complicated space. And but there's also a walk-in cooler attached to it. Or we built the walk-in cooler first and then sort of built the kitchen next to it. So it's basically just an open room that we framed in, insulated, slapped up drywall, put FDF what is the name of the paneling, the white stuff.
Oh yeah, like that plastic stuff so you can wash it really.
FDP or I don't remember the name of the paneling right offhand. Yeah, the super easily spray down, easy to clean stuff. And it wasn't necessary to do everything across the board with that, but in my mind, it also wasn't that much more expensive to just wall it out with 8 foot, because it comes in 8 foot sheets, and just panel the whole thing and make it look like a legitimate kitchen. So that's what we did for an extra few $100. So I think all the framing materials, insulation, maybe $3,000.
Okay. Was the cooler expensive, or you didn't? You said you built one and
started buying one. We built one, framed it out, insulated it, and then put additional insulation, three layers deep of the styrofoam insulation on top of the fiberglass insulation, and also did that up on the ceiling too. And it's run with a big air conditioner and CoolBot.
So a CoolBot, cool. Yeah, those have made turning refrigerator space so much easier for homesteaders to
yes
so much easier and so much more
definitely
affordable.
It, like, that's not hard to do either. You can find people that have walk-in refrigerators, panels, and kind of like kits, but you know, it kind of depends on, if I had to do it again, I would look maybe at the cost efficiency of something like that, deconstructing something that somebody's built and then reconstructing it and having it in a different location than where it is now. Because the way that we did it is, it's kind of stupid. Because we just, there was a window in the barn. So that's where it went, because there was a window and we didn't need to cut anything in addition to, like, okay. So it's just, we did a lot of things here that didn't look, and hindsight's always 20/20, that didn't really make sense. But like, I'm a suburb kid. You know, my parents are suburb kids. My mom grew up in the country, dirt poor, but like, my dad was a suburb kid. I'm a suburb kid. We're out here just trying to figure stuff out. We don't know what we're right. doing. So we kind of did the best we could with the knowledge that we had. And would we have done things differently? Well, sure, but this is what we did. But yeah, the long and short of it is, building a walk-in cooler is not as complicated as we think it is. Building a commercial kitchen is not as complicated as it seems to be. And then inspectors, like USDA inspectors, aren't as intimidating as everyone makes them out to be. As long as you know the rules, follow mm-hmm. the rules, and aren't a jerk when they come to inspect your stuff and look at it as an opportunity to learn, then like, they actually, most of them like helping you, like teaching people. And if you're open and receptive to learning things and saying, oh yeah, well, my labels are wrong, or, oh yeah, I didn't understand that, I'll do this differently, they'll, you know, most of the inspectors and people that we deal with in terms of like the mobile, because we also have to have a mobile license and a small mobile fridge, which we just slapped okay. wheels on a small refrigerator, and now it's a portable refrigerator. There's all sorts of like little nifty workarounds that you can just make it work. Okay. And in the eyes of the inspecting institutions, they don't really care as long as it works.
Right. Yeah. They just care that the food is kept at the proper temperature.
Yeah. And that's even a weird thing too, because a lot of inspectors understand that lacto-fermentation was a food preservation process.
Right.
Before refrigeration was a thing. So, but it once they're packed in the way that we pack them, they have to be refrigerated because they can't like off gas properly. So there's some weird things, and that's where it gets, there's like, it's a kind of an interesting gray area with cottage foods and other foods, because either fermented foods are like good or they're not. Like, you can test the pH and it's good or it's not. Like, some stuff that's questionable with regard to pH, I'll keep and eat myself, but it's not something I would sell, but it's safe ish. Okay. And until it's not, and then, you know, but I'm like, blah, 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 blah.
No, I want to get back to that, but I want to ask you two questions about stuff you just said before I get back to that. Mm-hmm. So where did you learn the rules that, you know, you said when the inspector comes, they just care that you know the rules. So where did you learn those rules? Are they easy to access, like on the state website? Did you have to take classes?
I'll answer to the best of my ability, because like I said, for a couple of years, Dad was the primary person interacting with the inspector. But yes, you can get a lot of information online, but really at this point now, if there's something that I need an answer to, I know who the inspecting agent is. I have his contact information and I just email him a question.
Oh,
or, perfect. You know, if I was going to say I was going to make, a mayonnaise or ketchup, like I don't know, just some product that I don't make now, I would I would just reach out to them and say, hey, I'm interested in making this. What do I need to, what do I need to know to do this? And he'll tell me.
And it helps that you have that good relationship with them and that you haven't been snarky and you've been willing to be wrong and ask questions.
Yeah. That's just like normal human relations, just like anything else. Yeah. They're doing their job just like anybody else who works a day job does their job. And, you know, if you have a customer or a sales rep who's just a total jerk, like you're going to be less inclined to work with him on good terms because they're a jerk. And if you're a jerk, then people that have to work with you are going to be less inclined to work with you because you're a jerk. So try not to be a jerk and your life gets better. Like, it's pretty simple, you know, like just normal people.
It seems that way, right?
It seems that way, but oftentimes it's not because, you know, a lot of times, I guess, like you put work into something and you think you know things, and then the reality is you don't. And maybe you think somebody's wrong, or and that's another thing too, is we've had multiple over the years, we've had to deal with three different inspectors. And that can be problematic because sometimes inspectors will have a different stance on certain things. And who's right, mm-hmm. who's wrong? Well, it doesn't really matter. You just have to understand what it is that they're taking issue with and then adjust accordingly. And sometimes even they're willing to say, oh yeah, like I'm learning. Everybody's learning. And especially with stuff like, and it's going to vary too from state to state. I can only speak about Ohio Medina County, sure. But a lot of this stuff is, you know, it's not commercials. Yes, we sell commercially, but it's not at a commercial scale. So the process from a manufacturing facility that's putting out, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of units is going to be very different than a small operation that's doing thousands, maybe 10,000 units. Like, and that's a stretch. We haven't done 10,000 in a year. We will. So it's very different. So they have to I imagine it's a struggle for them to see a big operation. Maybe a dairy would be like something that's a little bit more tangible for people. It's very different to see a commercial dairy with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of head of cattle versus a smaller dairy operation who's running a small herd of like 10 or 20.
Right.
Similar processes are in place, but they're all being executed very differently.
Okay. Yeah. That all makes super sense to me. And, yeah. So let's move on to talking about the actual ferment part.
Okay.
If you're okay with that.
Sure.
So fermenting, I guess we'll just go really back to basics for people that don't know what it is. What, you know, fermenting, what is it? And I know you're doing mostly vegetables, right? At this point.
Yes.
Okay. Not fruit, not sourdough, which is a form of fermentation. Just mostly
not for
vegetables.
Sale. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So fermenting, the art of lactofermentation, it's really quite simple. When you add salt to vegetable matter, and let's just say sauerkraut, because that's kind of like the easy, tangible thing that a lot of people are familiar with. When you chop cabbage and then add salt to it, by the process of osmosis, salt draws the water that's in the cabbage out of the cabbage. So, you know, you don't want to add too much salt. You don't want to add too little salt. So you can use like 2% of salt to the weight of your cabbage is kind of a good benchmark for starters. And then mix it all together, scrunch it up with your hands, crunch, 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 let it sit and, you know, for 15 minutes. And eventually that water will get drawn out of the cabbage. And then once you put it in a fermenting vessel, whether it's a big jar or a 5-gallon bucket that's food grade, or one of the old school crocks that your grandma and grandpa had or whatever it is that you're using, and then have the vegetable matter pressed down either with weights or some sort of contraption on their stones, bags of water with rocks on them. What, there's all kinds of ways, but the,
right.
the
yeah.
what you want to do is just have the natural salt brine that is created from the existing water in the vegetable matter and the salt that you added. You want to have all of your vegetable matter underneath that brine so that you've got a anaerobic environment and all of the natural bacterias and all of the good stuff that's on the plants naturally that that engages the process of lactofermentation. And then over time, it begins almost immediately, but mm-hmm. over time you have fermented vegetables, and it's awesome. Really a simple process.
It is simple, but it's
intimidating.
It is intimidating. And I'm glad you just explained it exactly like that, because you make it sound so simple, which it really is. And yet the chemistry behind it is complicated, but it really is simple to do. So how do you decide? And now I assume that in a commercial operation like you're doing, you're probably using airlocks. Mm-hmm. How do you decide when it's done?
Yeah. So when we started, and this is how you would do it if you were just doing it at home, you try it. As soon as you add the salt, as soon as you get the crunch, crunch, crunch with your hands in your big bowl or whatever you're using to mix everything up in, just taste it right there when it's freshly salted and see what the texture is like, see what the taste is like, see, just kind of have that experience. And then once you put it in, you know, put it in your fermenting vessel, whether it's a countertop level mason jar and a spring or with some glass weights or whatever, you let it sit a couple days and then taste it again. Let it after a week, taste it again. You kind of have to be careful every time you do that, though, because each time you break into your ferment and then get in there, you increase the risk of introducing the nasties. And the nasties are just everything that comes in from the air. So, you know, just as long as you understand that every time you open it and expose it to air, you're increasing the likelihood of it junking out, that's fine. But that's how you know. And it's going to vary on the ambient room temperature of your kitchen. Yeah. If you keep it next to your refrigerator, which is going to generate a little bit more heat, and then you've got like the old school stories of like Korean grandmothers making kimchi for that buried it in the ground for 6 months. When stuff's buried in the ground, it's at a lower temperature and it's going to ferment slower. So that's what, when your fermented stuff goes into the fridge, it doesn't stop fermenting. It just slows it down dramatically, because what you've got in your fermented vegetables are live, active cultures that are alive. So, and they die when they're heated and cooked. And that's what's, when you see right. sauerkraut in a bag or on the shelf at the supermarket, it's been pasteurized and cooked and it's no longer alive and active and, you know, has all the beneficial probiotics and a lot of the good stuff that we like with lacto-fermented stuff. It was fermented at one point, but it is no longer fermenting.
Right.
So how do you know it's done? It's done when you like it.
Okay.
And over time, as you do it enough, you'll just understand. And it's good to keep records. Like we still keep logbooks and keep notes about, you know, whatever, you know, maybe I made something like, for example, maybe some cabbage was old and it was not bad yet, but also wasn't as good as the rest of the other batches that I made. So this one batch, if it goes bad, I have some idea of why. Okay. And so just keep notes on everything and test things. And then over time, you'll just have a better idea with practice of when it's ready and when it's not. And you can't really let it go too. That's one thing that I have learned. And just to like fully answer your question is there's really no, I've found no benefit for in letting things go for long periods of time, like 30 days versus 90 days or 100 days or 120 days. The texture, once you reach like 60 days versus 100 days, there's not a considerable amount of textural change or flavor, things like that. It's kind of done. It's done.
But you were also speaking about pH. So how, what makes you decide to test pH, or do you do that always? It's not something I've ever done with my ferments. So
yeah, that's just part of the selling it commercially, okay, is having pH records. And you know, you can at home. I never did before either. Okay. When I was making stuff earlier in my younger years, just for fun, like making Rejuvelac or other just fermented whatever experiments I was doing.
And right,
I never tested, because if your ferment goes bad, you're going to know it. Like there's a difference between yeast, which is called cam yeast on top, KHAM, and mold. Mold looks like mold. Yeast just looks like floating yeasty things that don't look like mold. It's a terrible explanation, but like, you know, when it goes bunk because it smells bad, it just smells off. Like
that was going to be one of my other questions, was how do you know when it's bad?
Yeah. Like I think as people, as humans over time, we have these things within us that we know aren't good, like rotting meat. We know that it doesn't smell good. When your ferment goes bad, it smells like just bad. And it's like an off negative aroma tang that's like not good. Whereas the other ones smell tart, it smells sour. It has that sour, you know, almost like a vinegary tang to it. As far as the pH goes, you can get simple test strips. They're cheap. And, you know, like we usually, everything comes out and, you know, they're varying colors. There's a color scale, and everything seems to come out around between 3 and 4. Exactly what it is.
So that's where you want it, is 3 and 4.
Yeah. Okay. But if the strips show, you know, there's a distinct difference between like the color that you want on the strips that we use. The 3 to 4 is like a lighter green. And then when it gets 4 or 5, it's like distinctly bluish purple. And so you know immediately when it smells questionable, it'll definitely look different on a pH test strip. And it's just it's noticeably like different, and not in a good way different.
So do you mind if I ask you what does your day look like, you, when you get into the kitchen, and like how does that look?
It depends. For example, tomorrow is going to be preparation of a puree, because I don't have a lot of that. And a lot of times if I'm making puree, and what I mean by puree is like we make 5 different kinds of sauerkraut, and we also make 2 regional ferments. One is a kimchi, one is called curtido, which is a Latin American ferment, kind of like the kimchi of El Salvador, and a lacto fermented mustard. So I have statistics, and I keep numbers on everything that I've sold. I know what sells the most. I know what sells the least. So if I'm short on something, and I usually try to have at least one batch in production in addition to everything that's packed and saleable. So but in order to make the thing that I'm going to start making tomorrow is a jalapeno cilantro sauerkraut, which is made with a puree of jalapeno peppers that are corn and garlic and onions and cilantro. And I make that in bulk and then I divvy it out and then I freeze that. And then so it's all portioned out when it's time to make it. So I only have enough for one batch. So like on a regular day, basically I'm kind of, if I haven't done it already, I'll take stock of what I have that's in production, when I made it, when its projected end date is, when it's likely going to be ready, what I have saleable, and then think about what I need to do and then do it. And right now I need to get caught up on the puree to make certain products. Otherwise I'll just get into it and make stuff.
So do you make the various products? You make stuff in really big batches and then jar it up and keep it in the refrigerator to sell later. Like how much of that can you do? And how far ahead can you do something like that? Because with ferments, I know refrigerating it slows it down, but it does still ferment even in the fridge.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I'm working on figuring out. Because it doesn't, it definitely, it takes more time to make a batch and do the prep work and make it and then do the cleanup than it does to take a completed batch and pack it and label it. Like I can, and we do all of our batches in 5 gallon food grade buckets that, you know, we've got the secret little hookup on 5 gallon food grade buckets. So, you know, each one of those generally will produce about 25 to 30 jars, depending on whatever recipe we are making and kind of how things turned out in that particular batch. So it might take several hours to produce a batch and clean it up, whereas it only takes a couple, like it takes half that time to put it in jars, you know, top off the jars with a little bit of extra brine, label it, you know, wipe down the jars, label the jars, stick them in a case, and then walk them to the cooler right next door. So I like to have a couple of cases on hand at any given point in time, because I may get a call and say, you know, hey, Rob, you know, we need this, we need that. And then I can just say, okay. And I can be there the next day and fill that order and also have enough ready for the upcoming market. But now with decreased markets, there's less of a need to have a full inventory of backstock. So it's kind of this balancing act of the reality is I don't know how much I need to keep on hand, but I start feeling uncomfortable if I have less than 2 cases of everything at all times.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And there's 12 jars in a case for whatever that's worth.
Okay. That's a lot of product you're moving.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't really.
For one person basically running the show, that's a lot.
Yeah, I think we've moved. I think I just sat down to try to figure out like what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And over the course of the year, we've probably sold 2,600 or so jars of sauerkraut. And then we also started bottling up the brine using little 8 ounce bottles.
That's right. I saw that. Yeah.
And it's basically all the brine is a byproduct of the fermentation process, but Dad and I used to take it up there and just pour out like little gut shots for people as kind of a fun thing. Like, hey, this is what happens when you ferment stuff. And people really liked it. And we're like, yo, you should bottle this stuff and sell it. And I thought, okay, why not? Like if I can make some money on this thing that normally just kind of went down the drain, or I'd do some weird mustard experiment, like sure. And so people use it and make Bloody Marys with it, or vinaigrettes, or marinades for meats, or whatever. But that's not really like a do what?
Or just drink it for electrolytes.
Yep. Yep. So I don't really like market it. I'll just take it to market because it's not really in demand. But there are some brine freaks out there, like my girl Valerie. She loves the brine and she'll come and buy just like cases of brine because she'll drink like a bottle every 3 days, but she's kind of an anomaly. So I hope there are more people like her because I'd love to cater to her needs, but yeah, it's a lot. There've been some late nights trying to keep up with things and manage things and learn all of the administrative things that dad did, but we are looking at making a big purchase in terms of a food processor upgrade. And that should,
I heard you talk about this,
decrease some production times and really make things a little bit easier to do. So I'm actively researching that, mm-hmm. and I'm excited about that because that should theoretically free up some time to do other things, whether it be increase, you know, find new opportunities for sales in new markets, or try to contract with Amish to get more locally grown stuff, or just do more homesteady things. Cause it feels weird being here, but spending like 10 or 12 hours in an enclosed room and not really spending a lot of time outside. It's so
that part would be hard. What do you have? Any products that you're working on to add? Like, how do you decide when you're going to add to your product line? Do you just take kind of like the gut shots? Do you take samples to the market and see how it goes over?
Yeah. And that's going to be yes. In short, yes. Right now we're pretty steady with like the five, and this is kind of a change. We had historically been calling curtido a sauerkraut. We would say we sell six different kinds of sauerkraut and kimchi and a mustard. But I started learning a little bit more about reading a little bit more about regional ferments and trying to update, you know, how we market the different products, and realizing that curtido is a Latin American ferment with cabbage, onions, carrots, garlic, and a bunch of spices like cumin, oregano, and red pepper flakes. And I went full nerd and started learning about oregano, and then made sure to get like Mexican oregano instead of the traditional oregano, which is like a Mediterranean. So what you're getting is like an Italian Mediterranean type of oregano when you buy oregano at the store. And there's a different Mexican oregano is a different species of herb, a plant. And it's got a different flavor profile. So I'm now using that and trying to dial in the regional element of it and learning that it's sauerkraut like, but it's not sauerkraut because it's not a traditional like cabbage base because of all the other things. So there is,
I actually have to say that sounds way better to me than kimchi. I'm not a huge fan of kimchi, but that sounds really good.
Yeah, and it's interesting because everybody's got different tastes and you know, what they're into and what they're not. The people that like kimchi love it. People that like curtido love it, and they don't like other things. So there's also, you know, I'm trying to pay attention to like just population demographics. There's an increasing Indian population around everywhere. And there was somebody at the market at a recent event, the Candlelight Walk, selling Indian spices. And so I started, you know, poking around, and I know someone whose husband is Indian and has family in India, and I'm trying to have her pick his mom's brain about Indian ferments and maybe do something like that. And yeah, it will be trialed at market to see what, if any, interest is there. And those will be made in, usually our trial stuff is done in smaller batches, like 2 gallons at a time. To see if it works and if it doesn't, because that way there's not a big investment into it.
So right now you're basically a one man business, because you're taking it to the market, you're making the product, you're doing all of the books as well, right?
I will be moving forward. Yeah. Because, my brother and my family's awesome. First of all, you know, when my dad, excuse me, when my dad got sick, the family rallied hard, and, everybody pitched in to, make sure that everything was handled. And, you know, my sister did a lot of things with mom, and my brother really stepped in and, handled a lot of the books. And I was doing a lot of, stuff with the business and correspondence with the VA and a lot of, so we were all sharing typical administrative tasks equally. And one thing that Dad and I wanted to do, and we started discussing this last year, probably around August, was to rebrand the fermented food line and into something different, that we just knew it was going to be something different, because people would ask us like, well, okay, you guys have a farm, your York Meadow farm. Like, what do you do? Do you have animals? Do you have cows? Do you have like, and we're like, no, it's more like a homestead and it's not really a farm. We don't grow corn or whatever, or crops. But we have a guy with us that grows stuff, but he does it on his own thing for his own mark. And it was just this, it was turning into this like really complicated story about like what we do. So we were just toying around with the idea of calling the fermented food line like Acme Ferments, so that when people saw it on a shelf, they would see, oh, this stuff is fermented food, and that makes sense, and I don't have to ask about it. Like Jim's hot sauce, it's hot sauce by Jim,
right?
You know, it's pretty cut and dry. It's so that in and of itself required a lot of work and with insurance and how that was going to shake out with the manufacturing of Bath and Body products and food products at the same property. So
did you end up having to get separate insurances for
those? Yes.
Okay. That's what I figured, because they're very different.
Yeah. So once everything got settled with, after Dad and getting the estate handled, and it was in the process of being moved into and incorporated into a trust. So like all of this was happening at the same time. So it was very complicated. But yeah, the food, all of the food operations moving forward will be under my business. And in the past, I was serving as a 1099 contractor to my parents' business, which was the farm. So I wasn't really a farm employee in the family business. I was a contractor. So all of the food operations will be under me, under different registered trade names, but the farm will still be operating like a hub of activities with different spokes of and facets of operations taking place. Bath and Body products, one spoke. Food,
interesting.
Food things is another spoke. Leasing land to tenant farmers as another spoke. We are hoping to lease a portion of the land to a friend of ours across the street who has an animal sanctuary, so she can graze animals on that. And that will be another thing that happens. And I don't know how that's going to shake out, but I'm hopeful that it does. And then that's just kind of the start of what the future has. So yeah, as far as the fermented stuff goes, like I will handle that, but help manage everything else. If any of that makes sense.
And I think a lot of homesteads / farms are going this way. I mean, I know a lot of the big farms, especially in the regenerative permaculture organic, they definitely have several different businesses under like one umbrella. I mean, Joel Salatin does it. And I think it probably is one of the best ways to make sure that your eggs aren't all in one basket and to diversify so that you can keep all of this rolling and keep it all paid for. So
right. Having multiple, yeah. like in this case, specific to the bath and body products and food, it's not just that they're under one umbrella. Like a secondary LLC had to be formed because insurance companies didn't want to cover mm-hmm. both in that way. Yeah. So we were going to, in a secondary LLC had was already operating here with my business. And as things changed with dad's passing, it made sense to just capitalize on the LLC that was in place as my business and do things that way. And by having multiple LLCs operating off of the same property, it provides additional layers of protection in the case that someone gets sick from the sauerkraut and they sue my yeah. business and me, then
exactly.
then that's impacted, but it has no bearing on the right. farm or the bath and body products in that business. And if Cody breaks his leg doing something up there and he decides to sue the farm, it won't have any bearing on the bath and body products or me, because there's one property, two businesses, three policies.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good way to go about it. And I think a lot of homesteads, well, at least several I know do that. I mean, I have multiple LLCs for different things that I'm doing, but still all under my same roof of my home and my property. So it just makes sense.
It can be complicated at first, but and initially there was a lot of thinking like, well, this is stupid. I shouldn't be doing this way. It's more complicated than it needs to be. But I think just like anything else that's new, everything is complicated when you've never done it before.
Yes.
Everything. Whether it's riding a bike or, you know, transitioning from Velcro to tying your shoes. It's like everything is hard if you've never done it before. But the only way to learn it is to do it. So we do it and we learn.
Well, I have seen you, and I don't know when we met or when I started listening and being aware of your story, but I've seen you definitely grow and change through this process. And it's been really fun to watch you go from being afraid of what was going on to being confident about the decisions that you're making. And it's really cool.
It's fun to share all of this with this little, and it seemed little at one time, but it's expanding. I mean, and what all of the things that you're doing is expanding. So the circles are getting larger and larger and larger that we're interacting in, but at the same time, we're realizing that those circles are starting to overlap, and people that, you know, I know, and people that we meet at different events know people that it's so it's like the world gets our little worlds of the various things that we do get bigger, but they also get smaller. If that makes sense, because there's a lot of people doing different things, but the mechanisms that are employed by those people doing different things are oftentimes examples from the big boys that are doing the big things, like the Joel Salatins. And so when we go to see him speak at whatever conference, we have an opportunity to meet him. And then we have an opportunity to connect with other people who we've connected with online. So it's very cool to, it's nice to hear that, to see that change witnessed, but it's also nice to witness change in other people and everyone else out there who's actively involved in these little communities that we're all involved in, because many of them are different, many of them are the same, and they continue to grow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, I don't know if I have any more questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this?
No, nothing other than just, oh, go ahead.
I said, we've talked quite a bit and I feel like we've given people a taste of what it's like to, you know, do what you're doing, especially with ferments or even just with any thing that you're going to take to the market. And so I feel like people have a good idea of how that
works. Yeah. And I mean, it so much of this stuff sounds intimidating and that, well, you know, other fermenting is an interesting thing. I'll just add this on there because this was something that Dad took into consideration. A lot of people do cottage foods, bake breads, make muffins, this, do that. A lot of people grow vegetables. A lot of people are out there doing something coffee related. A lot of people are doing popcorn stuff. A lot of people, there's a lot of common trends in and around farmers markets that you can see if you go to different farmers markets. There are not a lot of people doing fermented foods. Like it's almost like a little niche thing, and it can be, it is something that can be done. And with a little bit of planning and a little bit of thinking outside of the box in terms of how you approach the operations that you're engaging in, it's something that anyone can do without knowing custom cabbage growers or anything like this. It's something that anyone can do. And whether it's fermenting foods or anything else, if there's something that is in and on your mind that you want to do to start a side hustle or change or do something to expand your knowledge base, your skill set, a little, just do it. Like just do it. It requires some discomfort initially, but it's not unlike working out or doing anything else. It's going to require a little bit of stress in order to grow, and not all stress is bad stress. There will be times when some of it does seem bad, yeah. But you know, when you're doing something, you know, weigh out the costs, do pros, cons, simple stuff that people talk about, and ultimately do it and try it, and don't be ashamed if it doesn't work out, because if it doesn't, then it's another opportunity to try something different. But ultimately, like there's all kinds of opportunities to do all kinds of things. And there is an increasing desire for people to, you know, support smaller people doing small things. And I think it's just a good time to do it. And because not only is it a fun little, you know, side hustle, but the community that's around that, you know, virtually in online and podcast land, but also the community that you develop locally interacting with people at markets and doing this it's priceless. It's a very fun and rewarding thing to do. And I think people are capable of more than they think they are. And so I would just encourage anybody who's even entertaining the idea of doing anything to try it. And if it's related to fermented foods, then by all means, you're welcome to contact me and I'll share any and all information that I can to help.
Yeah, I agree. I couldn't say it better. I like that. And that's why at the end of every podcast, I tell people, grow where you're planted.
100%.